I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Martin, it's been an amazingly busy week in politics in Australia and beyond, although I suppose in this field of discourse, the word, the adverb or whatever adjective, noun, verb, amazing isn't really required. It's just another week.
I think, yeah, it's, I hear all that terms amazing week, and I'm thinking, for those of us who've been around the track for a while, it's probably business as usual. People leaving political parties, you know, scandals, fallouts, those sorts of things. We've come accustomed to it. I remember a few weeks ago saying it was almost relieving to have a slightly quieter month or two. But this year started with a bit of a bang.
It has, hasn't it? And this is all, of course, in the interests of governing, we, the governed. It's good for us to watch on and make sure it's all happening just the way it ought to. But tell me this, Alan Tudge, former Liberal member, recent witness in the Robo Debt Royal Commission, had some, you know, some difficult times in his life, and one does reflect on the challenges that politicians have. But what's Alan Tudge's resignation all about? And the PM seemed to have been rather nice, polite, and almost caring in his comments in the Parliament as well.
Well, I think the reason why people are being, you know, polite and caring is, I think he's alluded to a number of personal challenges, shall we say, that are factors behind his decision. And I'm not across the full suite of those, and I don't, but I think that things have been very, very messy, shall we say, and complicated for Alan Tudge ever since those revelations of his affair with his former staff member were unveiled. And then, you know, that led to him actually being dumped or officially stood aside from his ministry role, from his role as minister for most of the second half of the term, of the last term of the Morrison government, which was incredible that he wasn't just stood down. I think he was drawing a minister's salary for the most of that part. But notwithstanding that, we don't like hearing, I don't think any of us that has a heart likes hearing about people's whether mental health challenges or, you know, significant personal strains on their lives, that's unpleasant regardless of the situation that they're in. But you did allude to a really significant flaw in his legacy, and that's that he was a minister, not the only one, but a minister at the heart of the Robo Debt disaster and fiasco. And this had an extraordinary impact on a lot of people in very disadvantaged situations, caused itself many great mental health problems and anxiety and beyond. So I think you do need to take responsibility when you've been involved in a process like that. And that was an absolute disaster of a public policy initiative.
Well, Lydia Thorpe hasn't left the Parliament, but she has departed from the Greens. Even some suggestions, maybe she's flying a kite about starting a new political party. Well, it's been a slow burn, Martin, but where have we arrived? Where has she arrived? And what does it all mean for The Voice, do you think?
Look, it has some very interesting ramifications for the Voice. I don't think it's entirely surprising. You know, she just had her own agenda, really, and had her own interests. And that's within a political party that's worked off consensus. So we know that Labor Party works off solidarity. And, you know, if you can't sort of handle that, you should leave. Well, I think it's not that different sometimes with the Greens. You know, consensus is an important part of what they do, and they've got their own process for reaching it. But I think Lydia Thorpe had, especially when it came to, you know, Indigenous issues and her approach to The Voice, Truth, Treaty, et cetera. So it's not a surprise. There is some benefits in both sides in departing. She gets to be herself and run her own race now. The Greens, she sort of cut loose from, the Greens are sort of cut loose from being tied to her when it was very clear that a lot of Greens members and supporters wanted to support The Voice. That seems to have been, from what we can tell, a fairly overwhelming sentiment. Yet their main spokesperson and a very, you know, outspoken Indigenous senator, keep that in mind, was opposed to it. So, you know, how was that actually going to work? I think it actually allows both parties to go forward. But there is some lingering challenges now with the voice debate. It might have been staying in that party, might have made her sort of toe the Greens line a little bit more. I think that she'll very much branch out into full-scale opposition to the voice and demand for a treaty. And that will muddy the waters a lot in voters' minds. Voters need to be really clear about what they're voting for. Sort of a division in the Indigenous movement, even if her part's a minority, and from what I can see, it appears to be, that still will have a bearing.
Well, it seems that Michelle Rowland, the Labor Party's Minister for Communications, has got herself into what is at least tepid, if not hotter, water than that revelation that she took, a reasonably significant donation from Tabcorp involved in the gaming industry leading up to the election calls, in a sense, predictably for an opposition for her resignation. But you would have thought a bit of a serious question. Why would she have taken the money, Martin?
Very interesting issue, this one. Interestingly, when she was condemned by practically the entire crossbench, but she wasn't condemned by neither the opposition nor the government, which tells you the different thing the Teals offer, perhaps. I think that they are very much going to be red hot on integrity in government. And I think they've got a point here. Even if Michelle Rowland has not actually breached directly the code of conduct. So what's happened is he's taken a donation from gambling interests when she was in opposition before the election, and now she's in a position where she has some oversight, significant oversight of gambling regulation. So she hasn't taken it while she's a minister. So it's not a direct conflict like that, but there's the rules and then there's the principles that you might operate by. And if you're taking money from gambling interests to get elected, people have a right to ask questions about whether it influences your decision-making in government. So now I think that is actually the legitimate case to answer there, even if she hasn't breached the ministerial code of conduct.
It raises the whole question of gaming influences and any significant sector in business, I suppose, which is helping to fund the campaigns of parliamentarians. Turning from parliamentarians, though, to someone who's seemingly getting the sharp end of a couple of knives at the moment, Philip Lowe, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, another interest rate rise this week, obviously doing their very best to make sure that inflation doesn't keep on climbing. But you do get the sense there are some political knives out for him. He must be feeling a little bit uncomfortable. Is it all unfair, do you think?
Well, I think that there might be some room for criticism here. The Reserve Bank really only has one function. They're in charge of what's called monetary policy, which sounds really impressive, but it's the ability to put up interest rates or not put up interest rates. They don't actually do that much else. They release reports on the economy and they help shape, you know, they probably help shape economic discussions. But really in decision-making, they do one thing. They do or don't put up interest rates. And what we could, the accusation seems to be the RBA have not acted as soon as they could, and now they have to act more aggressively. And we've got inflation running a very high level in Australia, the highest it's been in ages. And you can only judge people by outcomes. And there's probably an argument to say that the bank should have acted sooner and they wouldn't need to keep raising interest rates so drastically and increase the cost of living, because it doesn't just affect home loans, it affects everything else as well. So I think there's some room for criticism there. And his term is up, so the government doesn't need to sack him. There's an argument that when your term is up, perhaps the government might be entitled to go in a different direction. I notice the government's been very careful about this and avoiding direct criticism. He's not a political figure as such. I'm not saying that they've done overwhelmingly, you know, a shocking job, but I think everyone is in a, you know, reasonable position of public profile and some power. You know, they face accountability like everyone else.
Yes, I don't think there's any suggestion, is there, that the Independent Reserve Bank ought to cease either to exist or to be independent.
No, and look, I'm not having a holus bolus crack at the whole Reserve Bank under his leadership, but his term's up. Maybe the government could consider a different direction, and some criticism, even if you're independent, is normal in a democracy.
Back to more mainstream politics, but a decision which I don't think has taken people by surprise. A lot of people would be pleased to hear about it, but very interesting nonetheless is Tanya Plibersek, the Minister for Environment's decision to block Clive Palmer's Central Queensland coal mine. It's not too far from the Great Barrier Reef, and that's the key issue as to why it shouldn't be allowed to go forward. Were you surprised? Do you think it signals something significant so far as getting tough on and working towards climate change control, Martin?
Tanya Plibersek signalled when she took on the job that she wouldn't be afraid of making decisions, long-term decisions in favour of the environment. And it's entirely within the remit of our federal minister to block certain projects on environmental grounds. And you pointed out some significant problems with that project. Of course, all this is sort of covered with a layer of politics because it's Clive Palmer, after all. You know, this wealthy billionaire's campaigned for office a number of times now and thrown truckloads of money at it, and probably directed a lot of preferences away from the Labor Party. So, yes, I get all of that political noise. I think that's fair enough. But there seems to be some legitimate grounds for the minister intervening in this case, and she has the power to do so. So as long as the decision itself is a very sound one, made on the right advice, then that's within her remit.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch, isn't it, and see whether we are going to see, as I suggested, more climate-related decisions made by the federal government impacting on states like Western Australia as well.
Yeah, I think there's some very real challenges here, because this is where a lot of those bigger development applications are taking place. We know, of course, the mining's important to the economy here. And so there's a lot of interests lining up in different directions in Western Australia in particular. And if I can throw one more thing, is that the one solitary member of the National Cabinet, I shouldn't use that word, the Federal Cabinet. Now we have another body called the National Cabinet. The Albanese government is Madeleine King, who's the Minister for Resources. So yeah, she's actually going to be looking after that industry, isn't she?
You suspect so. Turning, though, to state politics in Western Australia, there's something strange going on. It's becoming clearer, although I don't know what the answer to what's becoming clearer is, but what's happening with the state Labor replacement for Alana McTiernan, who said she's going, but she hasn't gone yet?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. It's about the way the upper house works in West Australia, and it works in other states as well. So she said that she's retiring, and I don't think she's not officially gone just yet, but she's not only leaves the cabinet, but she leaves the parliament. And when she leaves the parliament, the Electoral Act decrees that, and this hasn't changed, by the way, with the electoral upper house reforms, her replacement comes from the next person on the ticket in the Labor Party. It's, well, technically it's called a count back. It's where you recount, taking her out of that ballot, recount what happens, and effectively that means the next person on that ticket goes. But it's really messy because there's question marks over whether the next person on the ticket actually wants to take it on, because they have to accept that role. They can recuse themselves. And then there's a question on the next person on the ticket as to whether he's got some very serious issues that he's fighting at the moment in terms of charges. As I understand, he's been suspended from the Labor Party, but that doesn't actually change the fact that he's on the ticket. So that's a very curious piece of work there, which could lead to some substantive headaches for the Labor Party. So watch that space.
Is there any other mechanism in the hands of the parliament itself or the upper house to resolve the issue?
Not really, because it's a matter of the Electoral Act. So what the privileges could do if that second person took it on and he's unsuitable, privileges could act against him. They could suspend him from parliament, for instance. They could take, in theory, they can expel him. We know they have that power, but that would take considerable time. And it would be a very messy process for the Labor Party because it would be coming through in the Labor Party ticket, even if that particular person would likely sit as an independent. So I think it's a headache they don't need. I think they'd be hoping that probably the next person ticket could be convinced to take it on rather than one problem.
I noticed the Premier, Mark McGowan, yesterday pointedly said to the media that Elena McTiernan hasn't actually signed her resignation letter yet.
Yeah, so they've got this thing, they've got this one this one valve that they've kept plugged for now, and that she said that she's resigning, but she hasn't officially resigned. So until she's officially writes to the president and resigns, nothing happens. Yeah, she left the ministry, sure, done that, but she's still a member of parliament until that happens. So I'd imagine that she won't send that letter until they can try and resolve this internally.
Martin, every week, but particularly in today's conversation, looking at individual politicians and processes, it raises this whole question of trust in governments, in institutions. And there's something called the Edelman Trust Barometer. It's produced a report every now and then. And its annual report found that almost half of Australians surveyed, some 45%, believed the nation was more divided today than in the past. And the sort of key points that come out of this are that the rich and powerful, to use some sort of expression you might find in Succession, the television show, were identified as a major force dividing society. However, business was seen as one of the most trusted sectors in society, and generally trust in government has fallen after soaring at the start of the pandemic. What do you make of all of this? Is this just cyclical? Is any of it surprising? Or are we headed to some sort of terrible US-type divide in our society?
Good question. So I'm not surprised by the view that society is divided, because I think it is. I don't think Australia is as bad as the US, but we do have challenges in that respect. So that's a perception, I believe, that's linked to reality. It doesn't mean that the country is about to fall apart, but people invariably take tribal-based stances to a lot of political issues, and that makes them harder to resolve. For instance, we've still got a really messy thing with the Indigenous voice, do we come together to work out the best way forward and agree on a principle and work towards it, or we all take our positions and fight one another? And there's still a lot of that second approach that's happening at the moment. But that's only just one example. On the trust deficit part, I think that this has been around a while, and people always ask us, you know, how did Trump get elected, or how did populism and, you know, one nation, others? People are frustrated with elites. They see them as out of touch. They don't see them as representing their interests, and that leads them to seek alternatives, and it leads to deep distrust both in politicians and in the mass media. And this survey really just is one in a long line of surveys that speaks to the same problem. So I'm not surprised, because I've, you know, looked into this a fair bit, but it does have ramifications. It even have ramifications for what the fact that ask us ourselves whether we can sit around in a dinner party and agree to disagree on something. I hope we can still do that, but I doubt whether there's some people that could do that. I think that we've got very, very set, and we have some challenges in accepting people have different views.
At a broad view, what's the antidote? What's the mechanism, or are the mechanisms to try and reduce that? Is it more education? Is it more understanding of the way politics and government works? Is it that the parties themselves, the major parties, are significantly to blame for what's happening? Is it the occasional or more than occasional sort of malpractice, to call it that, in government that makes it inevitable?
Well, I think you've raised a few of those, and I think there's probably not one cause. So if you look at leadership, if your leaders are arguing constantly with one another and they're rarely finding common ground, is it any wonder that people get divided when leaders are divided? So I think they bear some responsibility for this. And in Australia, because you pointed to COVID, I think there was actually a marked change during COVID, and now we're changing back to where we were before COVID. But during COVID, there was a consensus on how to deal with a major health issue. It wasn't an entire consensus across the board. There was, you know, anti-vaxxers, et cetera. But probably around about 80% of the community were on board, which is a substantial number. So that's an example of leaders agreeing and then community agreeing. I think that in terms of community, you've got things like social media where anyone can jump on board and have a crack at someone now. And you're still seeing a lot of abuse through social media and things like that. And as soon as someone makes it personal and attacks someone, I think they actually get more entrenched in their positions and not less. So finding ways to have disagreements, but in, you know, a civil way, can be helpful as well. So I think we can't just leave it to leaders. Education is an important one. People getting educated about a variety of perspectives, but also discussing how you engage politically, but also socially as well, is important from a young age.
It is interesting that business are much more trusted. I guess they seem to be more evidence-based, got their hands in the real world and acting most of the time logically.
Yeah, I think that's that was an interesting one. Businesses have been, our big businesses have probably been around a while. Smart businesses spend a lot of time in working on their image and making sure that they're giving things to the community, they're contributing to the community. So if you're a really clever business that invests longer term in the communities that you work in, that you draw your business from, I think you can, you know, develop a real rapport there. And I know that if you're looking at the way business is discussed in universities, that's actually a huge part of training future leaders. I wouldn't pretend all business leaders respond like that, but the smart ones do.
Martin, it's been lovely talking with you as usual. Thank you for canvassing those various issues, and look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.